What I'm going to talk about today really started about 13 years ago when I started working on the problem of long run-out landslides for a brief time. And probably in this group, everybody knows what a long run-out landslide is. One of my favorite pictures comes from the Sherman Glacier slide. Here's the Sherman Glacier in Alaska. There was the 1964 Alaskan earthquake, and the top of this mountain right here fell off, became this little cavity here, and spread itself out along the Sherman Glacier. And what makes it nice is that there are these wonderful aerial before and after pictures, and it's very easy to see the shape of the deposit, the fact that it flowed down, began to made a turn, and actually started flowing down the glacier before it came to a halt. And these are very large events. If you think of cubic kilometers of rock involved, and the point is, they're called long run-out because the distance they travel horizontally is much, much greater than the distance they travel vertically. And this picture is a Mars Global Surveyor shot of Mars 1, which holds the record because this is the very end of it. It flowed out about 50 times further than it fell down the slope. And the interesting thing is, if you take the ratio of how far they fall to how far they ran out, this is something that has been noted to decrease with volume. Phil Schaller, who was the name just blew out of my head, his advisor at Caltech, compiled a database of some 300 events, all of which are represented by crosses here. And here we have H over L as a function of volume in meters cubed. If you can't read it, this is 10 to the 13th meters cubed and 10 to the 14th. So we're talking about a lot of rock here. But you will notice that this ratio tends to go down with the volume, although there's a lot of scatter because this doesn't take into account if you're in a valley, if there's a wall on the other side, if it ran into other things and things like that.
Here, with the length of the runoff is to the front end.
Yes, it's always in the geological data. And don't worry.
No, not to the center of mass.
It's right here. It's mentioned in the next slide. The point here is that this is often interpreted as an effective friction coefficient by geologists, which it very well may not be. I'm not even sure it makes sense to talk about an effective friction coefficient even with regards to the center of mass in this business, because it's strictly only true for solid blocks to think of it that way, in which case it would also have to go from the center of mass, but it basically would be anyway. And this led to a whole bunch of theories that that somehow the thing rode on a thin layer of air, that there's enough energy to melt the layer at the bottom, which lubricated it, that it was somehow entrained air to fluidize the material, there was water in there to lubricate things, or there's no extraordinary need. Is actually, if you follow the center of mass from the beginning to the center of mass at the end, then the H over L's don't look all that outrageous for materials. So my question I wanted to ask was, is there a reduction in the effective friction coefficient, which I represent as the base shear stress, the normal stress? And so this was actually done about 13 years ago, that only appeared about 10 years ago. We did a computer simulation study where we took a mass of material on a hill, let it go down, have a little gentle curving section to a flat section like this to get an H over L, and which I define in the standard way to compare with the standard data. And we ran this for 2D particles, 10,000 to 1,000,000 particles, and the 1,000,000 particle simulation probably held the record for at least a decade. It took 14 months to run between 1991 and 1992 on the computers that were available. And here's just a picture of the early deformation of the slide and some pretty pictures of what the 1,000,000 particle simulation looked like at the end.
What's the color coding?
The color coding, if you notice, is stratigraphy.
Can you tell us something about the nature of the particles?
These are just simple 2D round particles.
And how were they colliding?
It's a soft particle simulation. done with spring dashpots. And I'll get to that in a minute, actually, because that's part of the problem. But what we did was track the stress history under the center of mass. This is all prelude Eckert, so this is, we'll get to it. Here we have the normal stress as a function of time, shear stress and their ratio for a small 10,000 particle simulation to the big 100 million particle simulation. The two vertical dashed lines represent where it transitions from the sloping part. That's the curved part between the dashed lines and the floating and the flat part out here. The most interesting thing is this last graph, which is of the stress ratio, just as a function of slide volume. And for the small one, you'll notice it looks like a clips here at about a half. And that was done because that's what the friction coefficient on the particles was. Couldn't get any more than that. But as the slide volume gets larger, the stress ratio really does decrease. It goes from about a half, that's maximum value for the smaller one, to about half that for the larger one. And one began to wonder, why did it do that? And one of the things I'd done while tracking these simulations was to take snapshots of the instantaneous velocity. In this case, this is the profile directly above the center of mass of the slide. And I went back and I tried to find some examples that had roughly the same surface velocity. For three different cases, all taken while the thing was running out on the flat portion of the slide. And there are three examples shown here, where I've got the y scaled by the thickness of the slide and the velocity scaled by its maximum value. And I got pretty close to the same maximum values. And the interesting thing is the profiles look pretty much the same, not a whole lot of difference between them. But what happened, and the only real difference is that by increasing the volume, I'm increasing the thickness of the slide. And what that means is that the basal velocity gradients are changing, and they're decreasing as you go in this direction. So all I got out of that was a speculation. The speculation said, could the shear to normal stress ratio be something that increases with the shear rate?
What is T?
Thickness. Thickness of the slide above the center of mass. And the problem is we can't explain this by anything. If you have quasi-static flow theory, the old soil mechanics stuff, it assumes at its outset that the friction angle is a constant, so you can't get it to change the shear rate that way. And even rapid granular flow models predict that this is a constant, although experiments and simulations show it's a weak function of the concentration. So we're stuck, and there's even a bigger problem that it's dimensionally inconsistent. That is that this is the stress ratio is dimensionless, and so if it's going to vary with the shear rate, then we need something to scale the shear rate with. And the quasi-static theory has no time scale, so we're lost there. And the rapid flow theory, the only time is the shear rate, and you can't scale the shear rate. The shear rate because it wouldn't get you anywhere. So you had to look somewhere else. And now, here we go, Eckert. Here's the answer to your question. You look to the computer simulation. And we used one of the very simple Kundal and Strock type spring dashpot models for the particle interaction, which means you get a stiffness, the normal stiffness between the particles, a tangential stiffness between the particles, which we assumed were the same for simplicity. And you use a dashpot to dissipate some energy. You also have a frictional slider that gives in the tangential direction. And the key thing about, well, two things because they'll become important later, is that this model gives you a well-defined coefficient of restitution that's a constant. Depends only on the mass, the stiffness, and the dashpot coefficient. And also it gives you a constant binary collision time. That is, if you have only two particles involved, the duration of the contact is independent of the velocity. So you look at this and you say, I've got two timescales in the problem that are now introduced by the contact model. And that is the stiffness between the particles, which is how the particles see each other elastically. And you also get a time scale from the dashpot coefficient, but the dashpot's a fiction. That's just something in there to dissipate energy. So the real thing you're interested in is the stiffness between the particles. So we take a stiffness, we use it to scale, we scale it with the shear rate. And this is essentially, there's a paper by Babbitt, Shen, and Shen in 1970 that looked at a very similar parameter, but it's essentially the same. And then, as far as dimensional analysis is concerned, I'm going to scale the dashpot coefficient just by the coefficient of restitution I just showed you, which, even though I'm not going to deal with collisional systems, it's just a handy way to scale the dashpot coefficient that has a well-defined physical meaning people can understand. So what does it mean? Well, this parameter has actually two interpretations. There are three interpretations in the paper, but there are two that are important. The first is that if you imagine a collision between two particles, that's going to cause some deformation and some overlap. And if you assume that all the kinetic energy goes into potential energy of the contact, then m delta v squared, there's no one half, there's two m's, is going to go to have 1/2 k delta I squared, as the delta V is going to go like the diameter times the shear rate. You find that this little parameter can be related to the inertially induced deformation. That's a deformation due to the energy of the contact divided by the particle diameter. So we'll get away from the landslides. We'll do some simple shear simulations in a 10 by 10 by 10 particle cell, spheres now. Using Lees-Edward boundary conditions means we have a control volume, periodic images upstream, periodic images downstream, periodic images shearing on the top and bottom to induce a shear flow with no walls involved. And this is how the stress ratio varies with this parameter. We're for a function of three different coefficients of restitution. But you sort of see the coefficient of restitution isn't very important in this problem. In this case, because the shear rate appears on the bottom, the shear rate increases this way, going from right to left. And you can divide this up into two regions, which I call elastic inertial and elastic quasi-static. The dividing line is just sort of a put it where you want it, but the point is that the stress ratio changes with the shear parameter in the elastic inertial regime and is constant in the elastic quasi-static regime. Yes?
Is this done by varying the shear rate at constant k, or does it have the character
okay.
of collapse?
I will tell you. You want to see how lovely this data is? Most of these data points you see are up to 9 points. They're done for up to 3 different k's, 3 different diameters, and a variety of shear rates just to get everything to collapse on itself. So you can see that this one looks a little elongated, but that just may be Excel's graphics capability. Everything just falls right on top of it. So
there's a crossover happen at 10 by 5 instead of 4 to 1.
What?
Why does the crossover happen at 10 to the 5th instead of 1?
Oh, well, because you've got to look at the definition. 1 would mean the overlap is the entire particle density. I mean, it's got to be a small fraction of the deformation.
It's true that 1 is not a big number, but it's still also true that 10 to the 5th is an awfully big number.
And now, well, if you think of it in terms of a squared particle deformation, it's a fairly small deformation of particles. 1 means you're blowing particles up.
What sort of volume fractions?
Well, these are, I forgot to say, this is all done at 60% volume fraction and a friction coefficient of 0.5.
Could you go back to the previous explanation of the deformations?
This one.
So you haven't taken into account Hertz and Hund
here. I should point out, I will also tell you that all the data shows that Hertz is a very poor model for granular contact. But in any case, at the moment I'm keeping things simple.
Mm-hmm.
I can deal with nonlinear contacts in general. I'll show you that at the end. I keep that at the end of the talk for anybody who asks that question.
Okay. How did you fix the pressure in your shear self simulation?
This was not fixed at all. It was all constant volume at this point. I fixed pressure later.
Okay. So you increased the volume until there were some number of particles in contact.
No. Here's what I did. I fixed the volume. I loaded the particles at half their size. And then I ran the simulation, started the shear rate so that it would order the particles as the shear rate wanted to, and grew the particles. And then, after a certain slow period of doing that, then I let it run for a while to go to steady state and let it go from there. It's essentially the same as taking a big volume and crushing it down.
So actually, if you ask what was the effective pressure in your shear cell, that effective pressure was determined by K.
Right here.
Yes.
Okay. That's the next talk. Okay, let me get on with this until I get the most of all of this. And this is going to make the point that if you do it this way, the idea that I gave that the volume of the slide increases, the shear rate decreases with the volume means you're moving this way, you're moving from left to right on the graph, and you'll see that the friction coefficient does indeed decrease with shear rate, although not as far as it does here. One point is that if you look at some 2D simulations, actually you do get a much larger drop in the, but of course the real landslides are not 2D. And it turns out, and I'll warn you, that even though it looks the same, I don't think it actually explains the behavior of real landslides. Okay, now here's what you're saying. The obvious question, or what should have been obvious, but I've been in this business too long to make obvious things obvious. And the point is that the interparticle stiffness, which is how particles see each other elastically, is an important part of granular flow. And these are some photoelastic visualizations, and Bob Berenger, who I understand will be here in a month or so, two-dimensional shear cell, where the lines show the heavily loaded contacts known as force chains that transmit the stress from one wall to the other. If I remember correctly, this is a case where Bob is rotating the inner cylinder in this direction to form these force chains. The point is that the degree, and this is what you're getting at, that the degree of compression is really determined by two things. One is the solid concentration, which incidentally at 60% is too low to have force chains in a static system unless you build them right. And the fact that the thing is forced to shear at that concentration. The shear that drives the particles together and forms the force chain. And the other thing is that if I went into the system and removed every particle and replaced it with something with, say, twice the interparticle stiffness, I'd get twice the force, because the deformation is determined essentially by the geometry and the necessity of flow. So all of the forces are going to scale with the stiffness. And the important quantity is the stiffness, not... Oh, yes, it is. And the... You have to be very careful when you do the experiment, because your particles can't be stiffer than your walls. What was I going to say? So in other words, the things scale with stiffness. And the other part of this is that obviously the particles are deforming elastically. So if we're going to model such a system, we can't use rigid particles. Otherwise, we get infinite stresses. This is what it looks like. And again, nicely scaled with the stiffness. Yes?
Well, if we are doing calculations or experiments that control pressure, then the rigid...
No, it doesn't work then either. Wait a second. I get the... If people let me finish my talk, I'll cover all this.
Charles, we're rather used to a different mode because it is a workshop.
Okay.
People enjoy being able to ask clarifying questions during the talk, but allow you greater time at the end, so there's really, cut off.
That's fine. I'm just going to say that I'm going to get to that in detail, so let me not keep interrupting the talk for something that fits better at a later point. Okay, so we're still at constant volume. And again, this is exactly the same data I showed you before. This is the normal stress scaled with the diameter and the stiffness. Again, there are up to 9 overlapping points for each point you can see. There's the elastic inertial and the elastic quasi-static regime. And yes, it scales with the stiffness exactly. And basically, the difference between the two regimes is that the stresses, the magnitude of the stresses now, not just the ratio, are increasing with the shear rate in the elastic inertial region, and they're roughly constant in the elastic quasi-static region. Okay, so elastic quasi-static, and this is what everybody knows is the quasi-static flow. I put this, it is actually a subregime, so I put the elastic thing out front. In this case, the stresses scale with the interparticle stiffness. You can get this parameter here. If you assume that the force on each contact goes like tau d squared, then you can interpret that as the deformation, the elastic deformation due to the applied stress divided by a particle diameter. And it's the system is quasi-static because the force in each force chain depends on its requirement that it fit the shear motion at whatever given the constant, whatever the concentration is. But you form chains at a rate proportional gamma. They will rotate for a while and then they destruct. So their lifetime goes like 1 over gamma. You multiply them together, you get rid of the gamma dependence there, and everything just depends on force. That's how that works. Then this elastic inertial regime, we have to look at it and say, what is the what is the variation with shear rate, which is essentially due to the slope of this line? It's a little hard to do. Standard way of doing that is you throw everything on a log-log plot, but we only have a variation here by a factor of about 3 in stress, so that's kind of hard to do. But what you can do is look at what the quasi-static value is and subtract it off and then put it on a log-log plot. Although, as you will see, that leads to a lot of scattering data like this. But if you do that, you get this. Now, everybody who deals with rapid granular flows would expect everything to go as the square of the shear rate, which means it goes that it would expect the line to go -1 on this plot. Actually, the line goes pretty much like -1/2, which means that the shear rate is varying linearly proportional in that region to, stresses are varying linearly proportional to the shear rate. You can understand where this comes from, because if you have enough shear rate, then there's the inertia and the motion becomes comparable to the elastic forces in between the particles. However, they're still locked in force chains, so you're still creating them at rate proportional gamma, destroying them at a rate proportional gamma, so the creation-destruction rate cancels out. Where the inertia shows up is that there's more force in the chain. It gathers the particle up, it has to absorb their inertia to lock it into the chain. That means that you get an extra momentum factor, which is proportional to gamma. And remember, this parameter can be thought of as the inertial deformation divided by the particle diameter inversely, and therefore that's exactly what's reflected in the parameters, how much extra deformation you're getting due to the fact that there's inertia of the particles. And so you get a time average stress that's a function of these two parameters, and it goes basically like a constant for the quasi-static part plus some other bit for the inertial part.
Excuse me, did that test the
addition substitution one? Oh no, these are, I think all of those were at 0.7, if I remember correctly. The If you notice in the early slides, the coefficient of restitution is a really second or third order effect, except at really high shear rates. So I'm pretty much ignoring it for the rest of the talk. Effective surface friction. I'm changing the surface friction of the particles on the stress ratio. And I vary it by an order of magnitude from 0.1 to 1 here. But you'll notice it has extremely little effect on the stress ratios. That is, it goes from about 0.3 to about 0.33 to about 0.37, somewhere in there. And the reason is that there's a common confusion in granular flows that I like to call quasi-static flows frictional. And the usual argument is, oh, what you're seeing is slip between blocks, and this layer of particles is riding over the layer below it until there's essentially a frictional response. But then you'd expect a big response, a big effect on the friction coefficient. That's not what's happening. You get a friction-like response, which means like a constant stress ratio, because you're loading things up into force chains. The forces in the x and y directions, which are, of course, what you average in order to get a friction coefficient, are always related due to the stress in the chain. And because chains don't live very long, they're very unstable creatures. They rotate just a little bit before they disappear. The geometry is pretty much fixed, which means the ratio of these are pretty much fixed, so that the shear to normal stress ratio is pretty much a constant. And so the point is that these are not a true frictional response, even though they tend to use constant friction angles to represent quasi-static flows. And in fact, if you go to rapid flow theory, you also get a constant ratio of shear to normal stress. And the point I'm trying to make is that quasi-static flows are really physically no more frictional than the rapid flows are.
By frictional, do you mean corresponding to a system with zero? By non-frictional, do you mean corresponding to a system with zero coefficient of friction, or corresponding to a system with infinite coefficient of friction?
No, what I mean is a system where you try and imagine the material as sliding along long surfaces that are interacting with solid friction. That's what I mean by friction.
Yeah, there are two ways of getting rid of that effect. One is by taking the coefficient of friction to zero, and the other is by taking it to infinity.
You get rid of, but friction would mean, infinity means you get no slip.
Right. You're saying? So they just roll over one another.
Oh, okay. No, well, you're actually talking at a deeper level than I'm trying to get at. What I'm trying to say is that there is a long-standing notion, and that the terminology has begun to reappear in the field here, where they imagine that what you essentially have is a block of material that slide over one another, and therefore that response is frictional. And that's what I mean by a frictional response. I'm just using it as a picture here. With an infinite coefficient of restitution at dense flows, if you don't let them roll, or if you're at a density in which it isn't possible for them to roll without dilating, then you would get this force chain-like response. And the fact is, incidentally, that going from coefficient of friction 1/2 to 1 doesn't change things much anyway. It's a very, very minor effect. And it's because it's essentially, we've already reached infinite friction at this point. Okay, now here's the interesting part. I'm going to do the same simulation, but I'm going to, in fact, same data. I'm just going to look at the normal stress, not the stress ratio. Now you see a huge effect of friction. You go all the way out here, you would say, oh my gosh, the stress has gone to zero, but that's only because it's on a linear plot. It really is only about two orders of magnitude smaller than that data.
Can you remind us which direction actually is y?
Oh, tau yy d over k?
I mean, so...
Well, Oh, it just, oh, okay, yes.
Direction.
I see, all right. You're shearing like that. The y is the direction of the velocity gradient. It's just, I could have done this, I should say, with any of the normal stresses. But putting them all up is too confusing, so I just use y. They all look the same. This is the data I showed you before. And you'll notice that the difference, as I said, out here, the difference between that point, which goes from dropping the friction coefficient to 0.1, is about two orders of magnitude. Doesn't go to zero, but it's as close as can be.
This is measured at the base.
This is measured throughout the volume. There are no base. There are no walls in the simulation.
You're doing just the shear flow. Thank you.
Okay. And these are all done by averages over the particle contacts in standard ways. Let's see, where was I? So, what at a very weak coefficient on what you'd expect friction to affect, that is the shear to normal stress, had a huge effect on the normal stresses. And the reason is that actually we forced the flow regime transition here. The problem is that all of this behavior depends on the formation of force chains. And if you go down in friction, force chains are very weak. And what you're seeing down here is an inertial flow. And this also brings up another warning, which is no one can see because it's at the bottom of the screen, but that is, maybe I can get this. How far can I get this out of the way? Probably put it in somebody else's way.
Watch your cables.
Yeah, I do. I'm keeping an idea keeping a look on the power cable. I think since it's an inch off the ground, I'm about as far as I can go. The lesson here is that if you start using frictionless particles, which is very common in this business, you can get in trouble, at least in dense flows, because you can prevent the formation of force chains.
Doesn't this have to do also with the fact that your packing density is 0.6, for which may be a bit low for frictionless particles, but for frictional particles would be okay. So maybe if you change your packing density.
Oh, and I'm ahead of you. I'll get to that later. It actually, you have to get up to about 0.61 for friction. I don't do anything with frictionless particles, but for mu is equal to 0.1, it takes about 0.61 is the answer to your question. So that introduces the inertial flow regime, which everybody's familiar with as a rapid granular flow, although that is actually a subset of the inertial flow regimes. And it's one of these cases where the stress is scaled with the square of the shear rate, as Bagnold predicted, although everyone should know that that's really just dimensional analysis. You can't get any other answer anyway, unless you throw other dimensional quantities into the problem. So every model in rapid granular that assumes rho, d, nu, tau, and maybe a frictional thing will give you a response that looks like that. Now, in terms of this scaling, if I want to use the elastic scaling, tau d over k, as a function of this elastic parameter, that means if the flow is actually scaling this way, it should go as that to the minus 1 power. And I'll show you that in a second. But here's what I've been talking about in terms of regimes. We have the elastic regimes, which are dominated by the existence of force chains in the flow. Everything scales as tau d over k. You get an elastic quasi-static regime, which is your old quasi-static regime. There's the elastic inertial regime, which is same thing. The only thing is you're shearing it enough for inertia to become important in the stresses. So really, these are the same thing. Where you'd want to put the dividing line is whether you can notice the effect of inertia or not, and I guess that depends on how close you want to look. Then you have the inertial regime, which are essentially free of force change, but not exactly. and these scale with the square of the shear rate, and you can divide them up into two regimes also. That is, there is a non-collisional regime, which are dominated, still dominated by multiple simultaneous particle contacts. And there is an inertial collisional regime, which is the old rapid flow regime or kinetic theory regime. And I'll give examples of both of those in a second. Okay, here's the normal stress plotted in the elastic parameter versus my elasticity parameter. The for a variety of solid concentrations, the these are all at mu is 0.5 and epsilon 0.7. Remember I said that in the inertial regime it should plot with a slope of minus 1. So here's your inertial flows out here. Here you see a range of where you can see the elastic inertial regime, although in this scaling it's barely noticeable, and the quasi-static regimes. Now, the interesting thing here is that my solid concentration is varying very slightly here. This is from 0.62, 0.61, 0.60, 0.59, 0.58, and 0.56. Yes?
I don't know if it's a question or a comment. I'd like to point out that all those black dots on the part of your plots corresponding to elastic regimes have a high value of the deflection of the contacts. Tau yyd divided by k is how much particles deform in the
contact. Oh, yes. No, wait a second. Hang on. I mean, what's happening here is something rather much more dramatic, and I think that's what you're getting at, is that the stress varies by roughly three orders of magnitude between here and there, which is accomplished by varying the concentration by 1%.
Well, yeah.
And the difference is that you've gone from something that is dominated by force chains, where the force chains are jamming the particles together and causing large deformations, to one that are where the...
Yeah, in practice, when such high level of contact deformation occur, I guess particles are no longer elastic.
Really
crushed here. It's my impression.
Well, I mean, I would, first of all, it does happen. They get crushed all the time. I would suspect that some of the stuff, if I wanted to run that as a shear flow, I probably could use tennis balls or something of that nature, which can easily take 50% deformation. But that's a. But I mean, we're trying to learn some broad brushstrokes about granular flow here. We're not going to get into details like whether the particles would actually crush under these deformations or not. But it's not. I mean, this is. This number 0.01 here, that means that the deflection is 10 to the minus 4th of a particle diameter. So it's 0.01%. And probably couldn't do it with glass, but could probably easily do it with plastic particles.
0.01 is 1%?
No, it's the square root, this is the square of the deformation. So you've got it's the square of the deformation. So you've got to take the square root of 0.01 is the fraction of a particle diameter. It's 10 to the minus 4 is the fraction of a particle diameter that is the. Wait a second.
The force is tau d squared.
Oh, you're right, going the wrong way.
The force divided by k is really the deflection of the contact. This is really deflection.
Wait, was this maybe I'm forgetting my definitions here. Let me just check. You're right. It's the actual deformation. So it's 1%. Right. Yes. Pardon me. Yeah.
So
I'm thinking it's the other one that's the square root.
My comment would be my spontaneous statement of what the important parameters are would be to say that K is not that important in general. So that's here. I would like my comment would be, okay, this black dots on the upper part correspond to situations in which you really crush the quintiles.
Okay,
I see the slope minus one, which means that K is irrelevant.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's exactly the point. In this region, K is irrelevant.
Sure.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
Believe me, I'm going to get to all of this.
Okay.
The problem is you can't, and there's even a bigger problem, which is you can't really do an experiment at constant volume very easily unless you use very soft particles. If you tried to use, say, glass or sand in any sort of, you'd have to coat the surfaces with diamond so that the surface wouldn't deform relative to the particles. So the point, what I'm going to get at is at the end, this constant volume stuff is just a point of reference. You can't really do that. And there aren't any granular flows except for things you create in the laboratory. They're actually done at constant volume anyway. And at constant stress, K is important. But I'll get to that once I have this as a point of view here. Okay, I take the same data and I plot it inertially. This is with the square of the shear rate, the old Bagnold scale. And you can see that if you work it out, that that if you're in a purely elastic quasi-static regime, it should have a slope equal to 1. You can't really see the elastic inertial regime because if you look in log-log plots, it's a very small change anyway, only a factor of 3. But here's your transition from elastic flows to inertial flows, again, occur very abruptly. And in this range, K is unimportant. I get to all this stuff because it plots, it's independent of K. Okay. The contact time, or the average contact time. This is another regime indicator. And it's something you can probe in computer simulations. And if you're in a force chain, then the amount of time particles remain in contact is dependent on the life of the chain, which should roughly be some way related to the shear rate, and therefore should go something like this parameter to the 1/2 power, or should be inversely proportional to the shear rate. Nice thing is about this, if we use a linear contact, then you've got the binary contact time, which is a constant. So if you have a collisional model where things are actually two particles colliding, rapid flow behavior, then all collisions have to occur at the binary contact time. So if you have a collisional flow, then the ratio of your average contact time to your binary contact time would be 1. And if you plot that ratio as a function of the parameter, this is basically what you see. Here is your elastic behavior where everything scales with the shear rate. Here's your inertial behavior, which seems to be roughly independent of the shear rate, but not, at least it's not scaling the slope to the 1/2. But the interesting thing here is look at the numbers here. In this regime, in these range, 0.56 to 0.58, you have contact times on the order of 5 or more binary contact times, which means none of this can be modeled by kinetic theory. It's not a rapid flow. There's still enough going on in there that there's still enough multiple contacts between particles to hold particles together long enough to increase the contact time. But the flow is still behaving inertially, as I showed you in the last plot. And now I can draw an entire flow map for granular flow at constant volume. Here's the volume fraction here as a function of my K parameter. And there's some rather interesting aspects to this flow map. The first is that there's a standard understanding in the granular flow world that you take a material, you start shearing it at low shear rates, it's quasi-static. And as you shear it faster and faster, you eventually get in the rapid flow regime. But if I start up here in the quasi-static regime, I shear it faster and faster without changing the volume, I end up in the elastic inertial regime. I do not get to the rapid flow regime at all. The only way I can get there is to change the volume. decrease the volume. The other interesting thing is that, remember, the shear rate increases going from right to left here. Here's your rapid granular flow. You only get that at low shear rates. So rapid is something of a misnomer in this context. It only occurs at relatively low shear rates or relatively low values in this parameter. And the reason for that is that there are two aspects of this parameter that relate to rapid granular flow. Rapid granular flow requires instantaneous collisions or infinitely rigid particles. So what you're actually seeing is you're going to the rapid flow limit as the k goes to infinity limit here. And what I've done is draw lines here for various values of the contact time divided by the binary contact time. You can pick your own limit to that, to where you want to call it a rapid flow. The interesting thing is that free force chains, I did some simulations where you compact something together and see how long just having this force chain there will hold it together inertially. And you get numbers like that are less than 1.1. So for a contact time, even if the chain gets infinitely long. So it's the rapid flow regime really is way down here. The other interesting thing is this. If I start with a rapid flow and increase the shear rate, I can get into an elastic inertial regime. And what's fascinating about that is here we don't have force chains, here we do. So I can create force chains by shearing the flow. And here's just some other, and this goes into the other question someone asked about concentration. Here's the same data for mu at 0.1 and 1. I should point out that in the last plot, the quasi-static to inertial transition occurred at about 0.59 at 1. It's about the same place, maybe 0.58. At 0.1, it's way up about 0.61, which answers somebody's question out there. Okay, but the question is how, the reason why you only get a transition between quasi-static and elastic inertial flows is that by shearing the flow, the force chains don't go away. You're not going to sit there and get rid, unless you want to smash your particles, which is actually a good possibility and for brittle material, but the force chains are going to stay there. And they're independent of shear rate, and that's why you can't go from quasi-static to rapid flow just by changing the shear rate. You've got to change the concentration to make the force chains go away. The more interesting question is, how can you go from a rapid or collisional behavior to a force chain behavior by changing the shear rate? And the secret actually comes between the relationship between the binary contact time and this shear parameter. And a second interpretation of that is that if you look at except at very small concentrations, this term is very, very small relative to that term. And so you can interpret this parameter as the 1 over the binary contact time squared times the shear rate squared. And what happens, what this means is that if I go to small values of that parameter, the shear rate is pushing particles together at rates that are becoming close enough to the rate at which the elastic forces are pushing them apart, so that you can force the formation of force chains at actually very small concentrations, we've seen them down to almost 45% concentration if the shear rate's large enough. And I should have to say that's a ridiculously large shear rate, but you can do that on computer simulations. Okay. Controlled stress flows. Finally getting to this. Suppose I want to control the stress in the flow instead of the volume. And the problem is that all real flows that you're likely to see are actually controlled stress flows. You can create controlled volume flows in a laboratory, But you think of chutes have a free surface, hoppers have free surfaces, almost anything you can think of really has a free surface, and the overburden is determining the stress at any point in flow. The volume itself is not controlled. Instead, the material can expand and contract as needed to balance the applied force. So what I'm going to do now is do some simulations and fix normal stress. I'm going to let the concentration change as it will. Okay, so let's look at some reasonable values for determining the normal stress of the system. I do this by backing it out from the sound speed. You can get an estimate for the interparticle contact K from sound speed measurements. LUSAN, old data, shows that you get something around 100 meters a second as the sound speed, which incidentally means, if you think about it, that granular materials are very soft, at least compared to their constituent materials. That corresponds to a K of about 10 to the fourth newton meters. Really, you think about it, it's pretty small.
Excuse me, you say that's a loose sand, does it change as you increase the density of the sand?
Well, what happens, what it actually has to do with is two factors. It's the non-linearity of the contacts, which makes the contacts stiffer as you load them. Mm-hmm. And the other thing has to do, the stiffness of the bulk material also depends on the coordination number, or how many contacts each particle has. More contacts, the stiffer the material. Mm-hmm. Both of those increase with the overburden. This is taken for some data that a fellow named Richard did way back in the 70s sometime. I guess actually it's probably the paper, it was reported in 1970, but it came out of the 60s. And it's basically, I'm saying, all right, let's take, and he had plotted sound speed as a function of depth. So I'm backing it back to the free surface. You get about 100 meters a second. About a meter deep, it's 400 meters a second.
Okay, and so that simulation where you have linear springs, you'd want to increase your stiffness as you increase the density to take into account the
It depends how you want to do it. What you want to do is get a reasonable model for the contact stiffness. And I will argue there really isn't one.
Okay.
So, then the effect of coordination number takes care of itself. Let's see, where was I here? So if I take this parameter 10 to the minus 6, which is a deformation of 10 to the minus 6, that means about having overburden about one particle. If I take 10 to the minus 1, it's 100 meter overburden. So one can say that pretty much bounds the reasonable values for the parameter. Okay, so what I've got here is a plot of the solid concentration as a function of the loading stiffness times particle diameter, loading stress divided by times particle diameter divided by the stiffness as a function of these various stiffness parameter values. So this case here is high shear rate, and this is lower shear rate, lower shear rate, lower shear rate. And what you'll notice is at very high stress levels, you get to a point where the stress itself is causing the particle to deform and therefore giving you a larger volume fraction for the material, which is this area up here. There's a line which I've marked as a critical state line, which goes back to some old work. I believe it was coined by Casagrande in 1938, which showed that when you shear granular materials, they like to do so at a constant density. And you'll see that over a wide range, there are regions where the concentration is independent of shear rate and the loading on the particles. And really the reason is for that is that there will be deformation of the particle contacts, but when you get that, when the deformations start getting small, the effect on the solid concentration stops being noticeable. But as you increase the shear rate, you'll see it's high shear, the inertial effects begin to take over, and you get a departure from the critical state line. Same stuff for mu is equal to 0.1 and 1.0. The interesting thing you'll notice about this is the critical state line value is just about exactly where we got the transition from quasi-static to inertial flow in the constant volume cases, and that holds for both mu is equal to 0.1 and 1.0. They occur at almost exactly the same concentration, but generally the behavior is the same.
Just could you explain the concept of critical state once again? Didn't catch it.
Okay. The critical state is an observation in soil mechanics. Casagrande, there's some paper, something about observations related to some the construction of some dam in 1938, where he mentions the concept. And it basically is that as you shear a granular material, it will approach a constant critical density. And the understanding is this, that if it's initially what they call over-consolidated, which is packed too tightly so it can't, the particles can't move over one another, then it has to expand in order to shear. And it'll get to the point where it can just shear and the particles stay in contact. You can also pack it in an under-consolidated state, in which case the density is less than the critical density, but because of the structure, it still can maintain a static force. But if you shear it, then the density will decrease and will eventually get to this point where the part of the material shears nicely at roughly a constant concentration. Is that clear, Jerry?
Yes, but that concentration is shear dependent, really, isn't it? It's not really a single value.
No, it is shear independent for a long range.
Long range means?
Well,
over a wide range.
Okay, over a wide range. Yes, I mean, here's the point there that goes all the way to about there without changing its density, and let's see how many orders of magnitude. That's two or three orders of magnitude in shear rate.
Okay.
At a very low loading. And, that's very high loading. Oh, wait a second. Pardon me. I'm describing this wrong. This loading is in this direction on this plot. But you'll notice that, say, these points all occupy the line there, which is going from here down to here in terms of shear rate, several orders of magnitude. If I get up here, it only goes all the way, it's only those three. If I get to here, it's only these two. But they're all, you're getting large changes in shear rate with minimal changes in volume. That's the important point. And that corresponds to the transition from the quasi-static to inertial behavior in the constant volume flow. Remember, the stress ratio at constant volume eventually decreased and became a constant. In this case, here we're plotting that as a function now of the stiffness parameter. For different values of the applied stress, you see for each applied stress, you see essentially the same behavior. It goes off to a constant. As you, for high shear rates, you get a deviation and goes off to a constant volume. But the behavior depends on the applied loading. But we can sit there and say, okay, there is a regime change from elastic inertial to elastic quasi-static, just as we did in the earlier case. And I should have mentioned actually with these points that the first appearance of inertial behavior is when it deviates from the critical state line, and I use that as an indication also. One other point I shouldn't have...
Excuse me, what are the sets of points with the same symbols?
Which one? This one? These are constant loading, constant stress loading.
Stress?
Yes. But one thing I should have pointed out, these constant stress simulations make determining rheological behavior a little difficult because your stresses are really determined by your applied stress. It's a major factor in determining the stress behavior. So you have to sort of back out what's going on internally from other indicators. And another indicator we use is the contact time. And here you see from U is 0.5, different values of the loading stress, and different values of the stiffness parameter. You see a behavior where essentially you're one for a while, and then you begin to vary with the shear rate. Sometimes there are a few points that seem to not be able to make up their mind at very, very small loadings. But and what's rather interesting here is that we don't see the indication of a regime other than maybe these few points in there that indicate that you're getting what I call the inertial non-collisional regime. You're either getting collisional behavior, which is one, or you're getting a behavior that varies with the shear rate as if they're locked in force chains. The interesting thing is very little of the data is exactly a slope of 1/2 as it was for the constant volume data. And it's that behavior seems to vary with friction, the surface friction. In other words, high friction, it seems to generally be a little less than 1/2, but it's still dependent on the shear rate, indicating that you're stuck in a force chain, certainly not elastic behavior. And it turns out to be close to 1/2 for small friction, except at very high loadings, where it begins to get a little smaller. And as I say down here, no, I don't understand that. Here's the flow maps you get for a controlled stress behavior. And what's rather interesting about this is now this behaves the way you expect it to. That is, if I fix the stress on the system, increase the shear rate, I go from quasi-static to inertial to collisional behavior.
In this case, there's no characteristic of collapse of this data, because once you fix the shear rate, you're pretty much loading, you're committed to that value of K.
No. The data collapses.
You vary K, but you vary it
so that tau D over K is a constant, and it'll collapse. And you have to keep all the dimensionless parameters the same. But if you do that, the data collapses. I admit that in doing this data, I didn't check it quite as thoroughly as I did the constant stress data. But I don't have 9 points overlapping. But in most data sets, there were a couple that I made sure overlapped to make sure that they went in. Yes, Gary.
The subject we're talking about now is constant volume.
Stress.
Constant stress.
Yes.
And before we were talking about
constant volume.
Constant volume. That's why I said.
All right. So we get a very different behavior.
The reason I'm harping on this is because there's an alternate picture that's out there, according to which the fundamental scaling variable is pressure. And it would be, I would like to understand if that is actually a different theory from this, or is the same theory dressed up in a different language.
I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about.
Well, okay, we can discuss
that. Maybe discuss that this afternoon, yes. Okay, so let's see, I go through. Now, the interesting thing is that if we take a 10 particle deep layer, which is 10 to the minus 5, here, you can see that we start with an elastic quasi-static value. It becomes elastic inertial at about 12 inverse seconds of shear, and it takes about 100 inverse seconds of shear before it becomes rapid flow. And that's a 10 particle, and it gets worse as the system gets deeper. Nice thing about a flow map, you can actually tell where things go. Same data for 0.1 and 1.0, same general behavior in both cases. But the interesting thing here is the controlled stress and controlled volume flows are actually rheologically somewhat different. And the most obvious case is that in controlled stress, you get the behavior everyone expects. You get inertial flows at high shear rates. You get quasi-static flows at low shear rates, but we don't see that at control volume. You can either go from elastic quasi-static to elastic inertia, or you can go from inertia by increasing the shear rate to elastic inertia. But you can't go There's no path from quasi-static to inertial flow without changing the volume. And to demonstrate this, this is something my advisor asked me to do once, and that is, I took this data for controlled volume here, and you saw this graph before for various concentrations. And then by a little bit of interpolation, I recreated the data using the controlled stress results. And whereas here, you see a sharp transition from elastic behavior to inertial behavior by changing the concentration from 0.59 to 0.58. Here you see only elastic behavior in the controlled stress results at the same average. Now these are average concentrations, although in the experiments, typical values of the RMS fluctuation of density were 0.2%. That's 0.002 of the mean density. So essentially, in most of these cases, the volume change is immeasurable. And here's what's happening. If you're going to force the material to support a stress, that means you're going to force it into force change. I have a structure of that sentence there. That is, that at very low shear rates, the only way it can support the stress is to form a force change. Controlled volume doesn't care, right? Volume's controlled. You can reduce the concentration. Force change disappears. The system doesn't care. But if in a controlled stress flow, it cares. It's got the only way it can support the load is to have a force chain, which means you're getting elastic behavior at average concentration that are too small to appear at a constant volume. And this next sentence I should have deleted in front of physicists, because you can argue that these changing the state is giving you a different behavior, different rheological behavior, so maybe different phase behavior of granular flow. Means in comparing them, you have to be very careful. And the interesting thing is that this has been known for 60 years, at least. I didn't even think about this until just a couple of months ago that I realized this is the same as what are called drained and undrained tests in soil mechanics. That is, they get very different behavior if they take a sample of material, put a porous plug on it, lets the water drain, the saturating material drain out while they're doing the test, than if they don't let it drain out. And it's kind of hard, the reason why it was hard for me to understand that originally was I kept thinking in terms of water. But if you look at the descriptions in soil mechanics, what essentially they're saying is the water's incompressible. So if you hold it in there, you're forcing the material to run incompressibly. And they always interpret it in terms of whether you got solid contacts and whether you're forcing solid contacts or not forcing solid contacts. But if you drain it out, then you're letting the material, the interstices between the material compress, and the solid material is actually supporting the applied stress in that case. So that's essentially a controlled volume and controlled stress case. All right, rapid granular flows. Nice thing about having a flow map is I can determine when these models are actually useful. And my conclusion is that rapid granular flows have run their course. Reason is that if I use 1 millimeter sand, 10 particle deep layer becomes rapid at 100 inverse seconds of shear, and you're never going to see that outside the laboratory. Long ago, I did some shear cell studies that actually measured heat transfer properties, and I had my student run at the lowest shear rates that he could run at. And then if I took the, although he was a rather neat student, so he didn't have 63 inverse seconds of shear, he only broke it down to 60, 70, 80. But if you take the values for three different sizes of glass beads, one more point. Turns out that if you analyze it, you should from the flow maps, you would expect the transition at roughly the shear rate times the particle diameter of about 0.1, which gives you about 100 inverse seconds of shear for 1 millimeter material. And these experiments were done, and I took the highest density we did and correlated it, and I found that for 1.9 millimeter beads, gamma B was about 0.33. It got to 0.36 for 3 millimeter beads and 0.34 for 3.75 millimeter beads. Here's some of the conductivity measurement data. And that's even worse. That's about, means you need about three times as much shear rate to get into the rapid granular flow regime than my order of magnitude estimate from the simulations. But then that's only an order of magnitude estimate anyway. So that means that you have to get up somewhere in the neighborhood of 340 inverse seconds of shear to fluidize, a 10 particle deep layer, very narrow layer of flow. Gets worse as the flow gets deeper at under Earth gravity. And so the result is you're never really going to see a rapid granular flow at Earth gravity. A bunch of conclusions. The point is the interparticle stiffness K runs through all this data, and it's a parameter that needs to be included in the rheology. It allows the one to draw the entire flow map. You need some parameters such as this one relates the stiffness to the shear rate. Between the quasi-static and inertial regimes, the only really new thing here is an elastic inertial regime, which is a part of the elastic regimes like the quasi-static. It's just the regime where the inertia becomes equivalent to the elastic stresses. We've shown that the stress-controlled flows are rheologically different than the control volume flows, at least at reasonably high volume fractions, which incidentally is where everything where all real flows are anyway. You're not going to see the elastic inertial flow in control volume cases very easily. If you estimate it, if you wanted 1 millimeter sand, I'd need 1,000 inverse seconds of shear to get there at 0.6. 5 millimeter plastics, I could probably get at about 10 inverse seconds of shear. And the reason for that is that the elastic stresses are really governed by this kinematic constraint of running at a fixed volume and a shear flow. And they're very large, and it takes a lot of shear to get enough inertia up to overcome, to be significant compared to those stresses. In controlled stress flows, however, the elastic forces are controlled by the confining stress. And you can always have a small enough load so that the elastic stresses are small compared to whatever inertia you want to apply. So you can't, it does appear, they will appear in controlled stress cases, which is exactly what you want them to appear in anyway, because that's where everything really lives. Here's just some example of this, but the controlled volume flows enter the collisional regime at low shear rates, because what you're really looking at is the rigid particle limit, which gives you the instantaneous collision limit, which you need for a collisional flow. And it goes to elastic inertia in the high shear limit, because you're forcing the particles together in the force change at a scale similar to that which they're being pushed apart. Controlled stress flows, they get into the collisional regime at high shear rates, as you would expect, and then go to elastic inertial quasi-static as you reduce the shear rate. Some lessons. First one I wrote is rigid sphere models are really inapplicable to dense systems, period. Frictionless models are also inapplicable to dense systems. The third one is all important systems are dense, I mean, face it, they just don't see anything that runs much less than about 55% by volume.
Except for turbidity currents.
Well, we're talking about granular flows here. And rapid granular flows require such large shear rates they won't be seen under Earth gravity. And incidentally, that's one of the reasons why all important flows are dense. Because you just don't see a case where there's enough inertia to cause enough stress to dilate the flow to the to 10 or 15% by volume. And I would doubt a turbidity current actually is well thought of as a granular flow.
The second point, frictionless models are inapplicable, but you also said the friction coefficient doesn't matter much.
No, that was the coefficient of restitution. The friction coefficient made a huge difference.
Once it got about 0.5, it doesn't matter much, yeah. Which is a different statement from saying that it doesn't matter much.
I said it matters. Oh, yes, okay, yes. In other words, going to frictionless particles made a huge difference. But once you got a reasonable amount of friction, it was a relatively minor difference.
This may just be because you looked at spheres, though. If you had
I missed one of my points, Jim. If you look right here, also probably a strong effect of particle shape. In fact, I would argue that, and I haven't gotten around to it yet, so I can't give you an answer definitively. But the particle shape is probably a hell of a lot more important than friction is in determining whether you can form force change or not. Angular particles will lock together very easily. And finally, there's system-wide constraints, such as controlled stress and controlled volume, that have a strong effect on the rheological behavior. And I think that's the end of it. I'm a little upset my friend Eric... Oh, no. Yes, I had one more point. Historical point. Granulars materials are solids. You go into almost any granular modeling, no one ever talks about solid properties. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is historical. If you look at what's happening, if you look at quasi-static modeling, this was a case where people said, aha, well, you shear the material, it behaves frictionally, that's a yield law. There's all this metal plasticity modeling out there. I can take that yield law, stick it in the metal plasticity model, stick in a plastic flow rule. I don't care about elastic strain. So as a result, other than some appearance in the yield envelope, the elastic strains really don't matter in the modeling. And they've been so the elastic properties are not really all that important. In rapid flow modeling, you say everything's a binary collision, which means you've automatically assumed that K is infinity. And so you don't worry about the elastic properties either. And that's why you don't see them. But if you put them in there, you can bridge the gap. And my friend Eric didn't come, so I'm upset. Now, if someone asks about nonlinear models, this is still an ongoing piece of work. But you can fit a whole lot of contact models, one of which is Hertz, to a power law based on the deformation. Hertz is the n is 3/2. And it turns out, though, that if you want to then work out exactly the same kinds of parameters, you get an elastic parameter that goes this way. You get which works very well. You get an inertial parameter that would look like this. However, that doesn't really collapse data. The difficulty is that if you go away from nonlinear contacts, you can no longer separate the inertial deformation from the elastic deformation. That is, you have a certain stiffness that comes from the loading, and you have a certain stiffness that comes from the inertia, and that's in addition to the first stiffness. So the behavior is really the same, but this inertial parameter doesn't collapse the data. But the elastic parameter does, as long as you're in a purely elastic region. Here's that scaled value of tau d over k and versus solid concentration, and up to the point where you get the transition, the data collapses almost exactly. So I can take that part into account in that regime. I haven't gotten any further than that, although at the moment I've once I get a review article written, I've got all the data, I just haven't done the analysis of it yet. At least I think I've got it, so we'll see what happens. In any case, I think that's everything I wanted to say. Are there any questions left?
This is more in the nature of a comment. As you pointed out really at the start of your talk, one of the key features of granular flows is this problem is the shortage of dimensionless or dimensional things around that you can use to create dimensionless groups.
Right.
And that has as a side effect the fact that one can have theories that are dimensionally correct and look very similar, but nevertheless have very different physical content.
Okay, I guess so. Yes.
And that's I guess why I'm concerned about whether this is this in terms of the equations the same or a different theory from a theory that basically non-dimensionalizes the shear rate through the square root of the local pressure rather than through the rigidity. And all I can say is that we did extensive simulations with Gary Gress, not of shear flows, but of shoot flows, where the loading is not imposed by the boundary condition, but is imposed by the depth of the flow plus the gravitational constant. So there's a well-defined pressure
at each point, but not for the system.
At each point, which you can use to non-dimensionalize shear rate. And our results for the rheology were virtually independent of the rigidity of the particles over a large range for both Hookian, your linear dash plot model,
but
and Hertzian particles.
Here's the question. Can you... the problem with all dimensional analysis is holding all the parameters fixed in order to make them comparable.
Yes.
And I doubt that in a shoot flow you can do that.
Well,
you can show me the data and we'll go over it, but I would say that I doubt in a shoot flow you can control the local shear rate and the pressure independently of one another.
How is the shoot flow different from the avalanche flows that you were talking about?
It essentially isn't, because those were two-dimensional. In a real avalanche, it spreads three-dimensional.
There's lateral spreading.
Yeah.
That's physics well beyond anything.
And there are also sidewalls in a chute flow that have to be taken into account.
Except for the sidewalls, it would seem like it should be possible to...
Well, the other problem is determining your shear rate, which has to be interpolated in data, because the shear rate is varying constantly across a shoot flow. So the question is, that was really the point I'm getting at, is can you control, even across the depth.
The input parameters of the simulations I'm speaking of are basically the height of the flow and the angle of inclination, as well as then the microscopic.
Then you're making an assumption, and that's going to be, that's where I started 26 years ago with simulating shoot flows on computers. It's almost impossible. If you're fixing the depth, then what essentially you're doing is you're taking a small control volume, and you're assuming you're getting to some sort of steady state before you can take data. That's really hard to determine. And going back to my PhD work, I'm almost...
Hold on. It was hard to determine. We put a great deal of effort into ensuring that we were in steady state. And we used a significant fraction of the computer resources of Sandia National Laboratories in order to achieve that.
How many particles did you run?
Hundreds of thousands.
How deep was your flow?
Typical results were for up to 40 particles deep, a few up to 100.
Okay. We see you're still working extremely shallow flows. Realistic. If you want to talk about landslides, you're talking millions of particles deep, for example.
Oh, that's
And that. whether you are living in an inertial regime there, which is actually what your data sounds like. If it scales with the square of the shear rate, that's what it sounds like. At such low pressures, maybe that's what's happening.
That's actually not what's happening.
Oh, well, show me the data, we'll talk about it.
I think perhaps we'll stop there for this morning. We're having a discussion at 1:30 at the port hole.
Okay.
Start today. This is more or less sensitive.